This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today on Dreamland, I am excited because I have a remarkable guest. Alex Sicarus is with us. You may have listened to him on Skeptico, one of the all-time fabulous podcasts out there. You must listen. He is also an author. He has got a marvelous book that is trying to come out and may be out, hopefully, by the time we air this, called Why Evil Matters. And that is exactly what we're going to be talking about today. Why does evil matter, and what is it? Because we live in a materialistic society now. We don't really believe, most of us, that this stuff can come in from the outside. Can it come in from the outside, Alex? Is there an external evil?
Well, you know, as we were chatting about just a minute ago, we had just an incredible conversation on Skeptico, you and I did, that I think is really the starting point almost for this conversation, because you so succinctly, with your history, put your finger on how you've encountered evil kind of inadvertently, but in your face kind of an evil. And then I think your experience in a lot of ways mirrors the experience that a lot of us have, where we encounter evil either directly or we see something that we think we just inescapably think that's evil. I mean, something horrible is happening to these children. Something's horrible happening to this whole race of people, and we see it. And then we turn to science. We turn to our intellectuals. And they're like, no, there's nothing. There is no such thing as evil. Evil is a social construct. There can be no basis for it. There is no good or bad, no moral imperative. And I think a lot of us are just kind of left kind of scratching our head going, but wait a minute, what did I just encounter? How do I reconcile that with all these people that are supposed to be the smartest guys in the room kind of thing? And that's what I think the book tries to get at, is trying to get at the source of that. And that's what I think our conversation led to, is you trying to get to that kind of on a personal basis. Do you think that's a fair summation of where we're at?
I think it is a fair summation. And we are in an interesting situation in the world, which you summarize beautifully there, which is that we have come to a place of indifference toward active evil. You know, in the animal world, there is no evil. A lion may eat a deer. The deer doesn't like it, but there's no evil involved. It's because the lion has to do what it has to do. And the deer is made in part to support the lion's life. It's part of the balance of nature. And in fact, human life was part of the balance of nature for a very long time. But then we began to change. We started writing, and we started then thinking also. And we are now in a situation where we can reflect on ourselves. And because we can reflect on ourselves, can we not proactively do things we know to be objectively wrong? So would you say that's true or not true? Are we still machines?
I have some really interesting ideas that spring to mind when you talk about that. I mean, first, I love the indifference, how you've used that word there, because I think we can't help but feel to a certain extent, so many people feel this, is that has somehow been engineered into us or reinforced in a way to kind of build up this callous exterior to confronting it. We get it, you know, because The flip side of that is you can't really go through life being super sensitive either, you know, because there's a lot of stuff that happens. You do have to kind of get on with life, but there's a certain degree of this indifference to what we know is wrong that I think a lot of us are clue into and go, why is that? Why is my culture reinforcing that? But the other point that I really wanted to jump on is the nature point, because I'm not sure I agree with you. And I think that there's an interesting, that this is where I would like to get with this exploration of why evil matters, right? Because Jane Goodall, who we all love and respect, because she went out and set up her little tent in the forest and started watching the chimpanzees. And she taught us so many things about our humanness by looking at us as part of this larger ecosystem, right? And the first thing she found out is that these animals are just like us. They're empathetic and they have the ability to love and the ability to care and the ability to find out what matters. But the next thing she found out, and a lot of people forget this, is they have the beginnings of the destructive part of us too. And they murder and they get together and they gang up on a chimpanzee in a way we don't totally understand. Right. And then we take that into the lab and we find some other things that a lot of these human characteristics. So to me, and I really want this to be a dialogue, so I'd love to hear your perspective on this, Whitley, is that maybe what if we were to find out at the end of the day, at the end of our investigation into evil, that it is more of a fundamental nature of consciousness in general, not just the consciousness that us as humans have, but the consciousness of other species. And we're all in this shadow, in the shadow, out of the shadow, in the dreamland, out of the dreamland. We're all in this dance with darkness, with evil, with light. And it might be much bigger than we even think.
I think that the journey or the struggle between the dark and the light is fundamental to everything. Buckminster Fuller points out that the atom consists of basically protons and neutrons, which are in a struggle, in a state of balance. And if you go all the way back to the Sphinx, what do you see? You see written in stone, literally, a model of that same concept. The courage of the lion, the strength of the bull are balanced by the intelligence of the man, just as the proton and the neutron are balanced by the strong force that keeps the atom from blowing apart unless we blow it apart, or something blows it apart. So that's there, but there is a level, and you know, in maybe it's more of a gradient in the sense that the chimpanzees, when they go on murder patrols, we don't know why they do it. Because we can't get into their heads, really. But do they? Is it volitional in some way? In other words, is it emerging out of egotism or anger or hatred, or is it more of a structural behavioral thing emerging out of things like population pressure in the different communities? We don't know the answer to that. You know, that gets me to another huge question, which is this: population pressure. I've had a lot of blowback from the visitors about the nature of population pressure that I talked about in A New World. They don't think of our wars and so forth as being evil. They see those as being responses to population pressure. In other words, they're instinctive. The Germans felt population pressure. It wasn't conscious, but it's why the Tsar went to war. And then when he failed, the pressure increased and it drove the Germans mad. And they went to war again. Where is there evil in there somewhere?
Well, you know, first thing, I love how you took it all the way down to the atom. I think that's awesome in that, and it puts us in a different space. It immediately puts us in a different space to start talking about good and evil. The other thing that I guess I'd say is, Whitley, how can we be having this conversation, this dialogue, and then how can we look at the social sciences and there's none of this conversation? How can they be completely ignorant, closed-minded, blinders on when it comes to evil? It doesn't exist. Like, you know, in the book, I'm not picking on the guy, but the Ohio State University religion professor who says it doesn't matter. It only matters what people believe. No, fundamentally, it matters whether or not there is a moral imperative. That's something we need to kind of nail down as best we can in science. And we can get there to a certain extent. And it puts us in a whole different place. So the one of the things I'd say is the kind of conversation we're having right now is the starting point for what serious science, what we look for academia, what we look for intellectuals to start investigating. Your whole life experience. Why aren't there 100 dissertations being currently underway? And because there's 100 questions there, right? There's 100 different questions. But you got to believe, I have to believe that is somewhat intentional. It is a shut up and calculate world. You know, it is okay. We get to the brink of seeing some deeper truth and all the things that could evolve out of it. Why are chimpanzees doing that? Does population control in some subconscious way drive our, all these are like dissertation topics. We get to the brink and then we say, no, just go build another iPhone, keep people dumb, keep them on Black Friday, get their Visa card out, but don't, for God's sake, let them think that they are more, that they are these larger spiritual beings that can really dig into these questions of substance. You know what I mean? What do you think about that? Are we being intentionally misdirected to not look at these deeper questions?
Well, I think that we're going soul blind, and the materialistic culture is what's doing that. And it happened for some interesting reasons, and it goes way back in the, when Christianity was invented, basically in the later Roman Empire, Jesus the teacher was turned into Christ the God by Constantine the emperor at the Council of Nicaea. That's to sum it up. And when that happened, instead of being students of Jesus the teacher, we had to become believers in Jesus, the God. And therefore, you could be, if you were a believer, you were right. If you were not a believer, then you were against the wishes of God and also the Roman Empire, which had identified itself with this new God. And you could be persecuted and were persecuted fantastically. The revolution that occurred toward the end of the Roman Empire remains the most violent and extensive revolution in the history of mankind. And now, where did evil come in? Because it came in somewhere. In the gospel, there is an extraordinary story of Jesus in the desert for this 40 days in the desert where he meets Satan. And Satan at one point shows him the cities of the plain and says, all of this will be yours if you just follow me. Replace your God with me. And he says, no. Constantine said yes, basically. Now, who was there? Was there somebody outside of us doing this? Is there a Satan, Alex?
Well, see, this is going to be really interesting because at the beginning, I kind of told you that it's interesting how our areas of inquiry are overlapping here.
Yeah, that's what's making this conversation so much fun. I'm loving it.
I want you to share with people what you told me in terms of your inspiration for some of these books. I mean, people know your experience with Anne and how you feel. But I think it was interesting, kind of the subtle differences you said, where it's not like a channeling thing. It's like of being directed kind of thing. And here's what because I don't exactly agree with you about Jesus, Whitley, and in particular, because I think that there is such a rich spiritual experience throughout history. And I think Christianity has blinded us to narrowly looking at the spiritual experience of so many of these great thinkers and forcing it into a Christian lens. I mean,
I agree with you completely. I don't disagree with that.
So I wouldn't imagine that you would, but I would kind of say that I think there's been some interesting archaeological evidence that has emerged just recently that kind of puts a different spin on things. So I don't know what you think of entheogens and that experience, but and it's not my kind of thing. I'm more interested in, for example, the near-death experience, which, by the way, Plato writes about. Plato talks about a soldier in this. So I think there are all these extended conscious experiences, including the use of entheogens, including near-death experience, that are all throughout history. And we do not, and we somehow put this modern-day humanist, which really means atheist, lens, and we look at history as if all these people didn't have any kind of spiritual experience, or that their spiritual experience couldn't be nearly as rich as, like, your spiritual experience is incredibly rich. It has ET in it. It has a direct communication with the afterlife in it. It has all this. And I would suggest that we should apply that lens to everyone in history. And when we talk about, Josephus and Jesus, we talk about Vespasian, you know, who is the emperor. And, and when Vespasian is in Britannia and he's running his sword through a Druid priest, and those Druids were incredible spiritual, connected in some way. What did that do to the soul of Vespasian when he killed that Druid? And how did that affect his life? And, you know, we all wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning wondering what is our existence and what will happen to us and what is happening to us. What was happening to Vespasian? And why does our history never even imagine that that should even be considered as part of our broader history, that all these people had a complex spiritual life? And I would again come back and say that is intentional. That is shut up and calculate. That is, don't think too deeply about spirituality because you'll muck up the gears of the machine that we have.
You'll maybe cease to be spontaneous and cease, therefore, to live from your truth and stop being able to discover yourself. That's part of it. The other part of it, though, is that we have lost our ability, and this isn't something that happened in the 20th century. It happened as history evolved. By the time the Romans came along, they could not, I don't think, feel their souls. I think the ancient Egyptians, especially those who were sensitized, could. The first real moral code is the 42 laws of Ma'at, which were condensed by Moses into the 10 commandments and form still to this day the core of all moral codes in the Western world. But they had become aware that there was something there. And this is why they had the story that after a person died, the soul was measured against the weight of a feather. And if it was less weight than a feather, then it would ascend to the stars from whence it came. I think that might be true. And I think that the triumph of evil is desensitizing ourselves to the way a healthy soul feels. And this is one of the things that excites me so much about your book, because it is a sensitization process from beginning to end. You, in the chapter Looking into the Abyss, tell us what you see.
Well, see, it's hard because you kind of took me down one path there and then you switched me with
switched you to another. But,
that's okay.
You know, I'm a podcaster too. I know what I'm doing just like you do. You do that to me and everybody.
No, you are. You're very, very, very skilled at what you do.
Well, we both are, I think.
Well, I want to go back to something that you just talked about, because I think it is at the core essence of the book. And I do, again, want to connect it to this dialogue that we had, because one of the amazing things you said when we had this dialogue, and we're talking about your experience and your MK Ultra experience when you were a young child, and you immediately went to the much, much bigger issue, which is classic Whitley Strieber, you know. You said black magic is like flypaper. And yes. Once you touch it, it's very hard to remove yourself from it. That to me is Luciferianism. We can put all these terms on it. You know, Satanism, Satan slips through your fingers. You can't find a historical Satan. It's very, very difficult to find. Same with Lucifer. But we understand these concepts. We understand being overstimulated by a need to know, a need to technify everything. That is essentially Luciferianism. We all live in that kind of world. What I took away from the flypaper thing that you were talking about is not that the Romans had lost their soul, because I don't think anyone can lose their soul. I think the light, you know, I think the darkness gets way overplayed. It gets way too much press. the light is what it's really all about. And you can always turn to the light. It's just don't get in that flypaper, because it makes it harder to turn to the light. And you might even get used to the flypaper and start thinking that the flypaper really isn't that bad. But the light is always there. The light was always there for the Romans. The light is always there for us today. But it is a problem. It is a problem because there's so many attractive parts, and we've normalized so many parts of kind of this soul calcification, you know, thing that we go through.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to be taking a break on the podcast, on the audio podcast, and you're going to be hearing some commercials. If you were watching the video, however, you will not be hearing those commercials because they have no video. But you're not lucky, because what I'm doing now is preaching to you about two things. One, go to skeptico.com, listen to Alex. You can hear his brilliance here, and it's reflected in every show he does. It's one of the best podcasts out there. You can't miss with it. His new book as well is phenomenal, and it is a serious journey into the nature of evil. Now, if you've done that and are doing that, I want you to also go to unknowncountry.com and do something that you should have done long ago, which is subscribe. Because if you do subscribe, you get all kinds of perks. We have a wonderful social area. We have Zoom meetings with our guests on Saturdays quite often, not every Saturday, but quite often. Every Wednesday night, there's a chat with me, and you can join that chat, and it's a fun, lovely experience. We have a free message board. As a subscriber, you can comment on shows, and you can listen to Dreamland, to all of this effort and all of this extraordinary journey all the way back to 2004. Plus, there are meditations. There are a number of Whitley Strieber audiobooks there. It's a really rich resource. So go to unknowncountry.com. Do that now. But not until we're finished. Okay, Alex, getting back to this issue of, it's basically what we've been talking about is, where is evil and how does it work? And, you know, I was going to bring this up later, but I think the right time is now. I want to talk about Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley, JPL, NASA, and the secret government. So tell us a little bit about Jack Parsons, who he was, and what he did initially before founding the Jet Propulsion Laboratory?
Well, you know, I think what I find interesting, and probably you as well, about the Jack Parsons story is his connection to Aleister Crowley. So Aleister Crowley is widely understood as being the most influential occultist of modern history, and his works and his writings still resonate with so many people and in so many of the wrong ways. And I always find it interesting. I almost say sometimes that I have the Crowley litmus test, because when you talk to people and they immediately say, well, gosh, you don't know Crowley, and you haven't really understood the deeper truths of his life. And I say, you know, I have read Crowley, and I think he's pretty direct. And the other thing is, I think it's just kind of common sense. We can judge people by the fruit of their labors.
Now, let me just stop for just a second here. And I want to bring up the flypaper again, because I know some very advanced occultists, obviously. I mean, I'm going to know those people in my life, a life like I'm living. And they are all defenders of Crowley. Are they in the flypaper? I think they're in the flypaper, aren't they?
Yes, I agree.
Exactly. I think so, too.
I mean, I like just cutting to the chase. Yeah, hey, but you know what? We're all in the flypaper, right? We're all in the flypaper to a certain extent. And we're all trying to, because I also know and am friends with occultists and people who are open to that, who have truly used that material as a way to deepen their spirituality in a way that I completely admire and salute. And they seem to come out the other end saying and doing, and more importantly, doing, living a life of deeper, you know, again, back to our conversation. What did you say, which was so beautiful, that the only way out is with love, compassion, and humility?
Exactly.
So if someone finds Crowley, and through that, I don't know how you would, but through that finds a life of love, compassion, and humility, then I say, wow, maybe I did miss something. Let me go back and read what "do what thou wilt" means.
It would be hard to find that in Crowley. And yet Crowley as a person, I've read his biography, was a very nice, lovely father and husband. What do you make of that?
Maybe I've heard some contradictory kind of stuff, but
you've heard some other things. Well, maybe I was lied to. That's possible too.
Well, we can never reconstruct someone's life, and I'm sure that there were moments that he was both. And again, though, you know, I'm going to keep coming back to this, and we're going to keep returning to this in this conversation. We are so limited in our ability to even try and understand what this means from an extended consciousness perspective. Like what you were just kind of freewheeling about the chimpanzees is where we need to be. We need to be asking, you know, what could be the nature of evil. And I would take the same thing more directly, you know, your experiences with Anne and after death communication. Where is she? Where are people that have had near death experiences? What is that realm that they are encountering? How does that realm relate to us in our own spiritual journey? The same would be true with out of body experiences and theogens. You know, I kind of was mentioning before, when we go back to Roman history and we look at Pompeii, you know, and I was there a couple of years ago. I took my whole family there, and you go and you walk through the ruins and you see how all this stuff is completely preserved in a way that nothing else in ancient history that we found is. And you go to one room and now they have archaeological evidence of the pharmacy. And the pharmacy in Pompeii has cannabis. It has mescaline. It has the root element of LSD. It has psilocybin. They were exploring the extended consciousness realm in every way they could. So we have a rich, we all have a rich spiritual life, whether we acknowledge it or not. Even if we try and close ourselves off from it, I believe we all have a rich spiritual life. And everyone throughout history has had that spiritual life. And I think when we start looking at it in that way, it kind of changes everything. Not to mention E.T. or, you know, whatever that is, right? Because that's the other place we close ourselves down from. And that's what you bring to us, is to say, hey, look over here. You know, there's enough evidence here where we can't do the shut up and calculate thing with ET. We can't just get up, which is what we do over and over again. We get to the edge and then we say, oh, can't deal with that. Jump over it and just pretend we never ran into it. And to your credit, like, you didn't do that.
No,
you ran into it and said, well, I can't just pass it by. I can't just pretend it didn't happen. And I think that's what a lot of us are doing. In so many little ways, we're just pretending that, you know, pretending that God isn't talking to us.
We're pretending we're not what we are, basically.
Yes.
And we're pretending that the world isn't what it is, because what we are and what the world is the same thing. A mystery, an incredible mystery. And we are light years beyond any other animal on the face of the earth. In fact, so far beyond that, calling ourselves an animal is only a part of what we are. We can never teach any other species on this planet the smallest thing about what we know. We can train them to do simple tasks. But you can never, you could actually train a chimpanzee to drive a car. You can certainly train them to ride a bicycle, but you can never explain a bicycle to a chimpanzee. It's not possible. So they literally don't know where they are or what they're doing. A higher level of reality looking at us is in the same boat. They can't explain themselves to us, and they cannot explain to us what they know about us and what we are doing. And that's why when you look into their eyes, you see that darkness. That darkness is their knowledge of what we would call the beyond, the truth beyond. But I want to get back, speaking of the beyond, to Jack Parsons. We diverted. We talked about Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley. Jack Parsons participated in rituals. He sat in the flypaper. He became a devotee of Crowley and therefore of something evil. Now, he then founded JPL, and where are we now? Let's fast forward. JPL became a very secretive organization. NASA, which has a charter that says it's not allowed to keep secrets, keeps an incredible number of secrets. The entire ET phenomenon, as it evolved, became entangled in this web of secrecy. Now we have things like QAnon. People are being driven crazy, basically, by secrecy. They know there is a secret government. They know something is hidden from them. And all of a sudden, out of that knowledge and their fear and the difficulty of their lives and the confusion, there comes Hillary Clinton is a cannibal. And I'm not going to go down a political road here because that's not what we do on my show. But that's evil in action, in operation. And it basically started, I think, with Jack Parsons.
Well, let's go back to Jack Parsons then.
Yes, let's.
It's hard to do this without just getting overwhelmed with name dropping, and it gets to be inside baseball. But then for people who, you know, I would just encourage anyone who thinks this conversation is going to sound like inside baseball to alert yourself to the fact that maybe you have a reason to dig into this more. But we have to talk in kind of shorthand here in order to get any communication across. So Jack Parsons, the interesting thing about him is he's out in the desert with L. Ron Hubbard. Remember L. Ron Hubbard, the guy who started Scientology? Yes. They are out there together, and they have a strange relationship because L. Ron Hubbard has seduced Jack Parsons' girlfriend, and Jack Parsons doesn't know quite what to make of that. And he doesn't know quite how to resolve that with a do what thou wilt ethos that he's hearing from Crowley and the sex magic that he's hearing from Crowley. But he's out there and they're going to perform this ritual in order to bring forth the whore of Babylon in order to conceive the Antichrist. And they are doing that. And here's the other complexity thing, more inside baseball. Their stated reason for doing that is to help the world evolve. They are in this kind of inversion kind of thing that we get into, that we see a lot of times with different groups where they go, no. This is to help the world evolve because, hey, look at the Bible. What does it say? We can only have the coming when we're all good or we're all bad. And you know what? We've tried the all good thing. That ain't working out. So let's look for the all bad. Maybe that's a shorter path. Now, this is it. You just have to go in. You have to get in the mind of the occult thing. But the other thing you have to get in the mind of is that these are human beings. And what is it like for Jack Parsons to have his girlfriend stolen by this guy and to be swindled by this guy? He loses a lot of money to L. Ron Hubbard. And if you look into L. Ron Hubbard, he is like the ultimate gangster swindler kind of interesting guy. But how does L. Ron Hubbard pop up again? Scientology. Scientology doesn't stop in the desert. They start it up. And now you go look at MK Ultra, and I love MK Ultra because so many people get so freaked out. MK Ultra. No, let's talk Stargate. Stargate is a sub program under MK Ultra. Stargate, which we all look at and go, oh no, that was kind of one of the good ones. That was the remote viewing. That was looking at Soviet spies. Looking at Soviet submarines from a distance. That's good stuff. That's Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ. Well, don't look too deep, because Hal Puthoff was Scientology. He was an early adopter or an early follower of L. Ron Hubbard's Scientology. Why can't people at the beginning see through this cult, which we obviously now look at and go, well, that's just a cult. It's just kind of crazy nonsense.
To be clear just about Hal Puthoff, he repudiated it a long time ago. He's not involved now.
Oh, yes. Let's be clear about that. But let's also at the same time be clear that a lot of the other people who were the early part of that group of Stargate were closely associated with Scientology. So again, I take your point, and I'm glad that you added that, because I don't want to disparage Hal Puthoff. But at the same time, Hal Puthoff is not only Scientology, but he's military intelligence. No, I'm sorry. He's Navy intelligence, which is kind of interesting, because Navy intelligence always kind of pops up in a kind of a strange way. And I don't know what that means. And I think, again, my orientation would be that Hal Puthoff has a rich spiritual life. You know how I know that? Because everybody has a rich spiritual life. So well,
I've known Hal for 30 years, and he does have a rich spiritual life, I can assure you.
See, and I don't. But I've talked to so many of these guys from that group, and it's just kind of tricky to sort through that history and really understand where the flypaper begins and where the flypaper ends. And we all live long, complicated lives with many twists and turns. And, you know, at the end of the day, all the evidence could be laid out to me or you, and we could say, thank you. Thank you, Hal, for defending our freedom, even though you had to do all these crazy things
right,
to do it.
Free Dreamlanders, Why Evil Matters is Alex's book. I believe it will be on Amazon and for sale by the time we run this show. If it's not, it will be shortly. His website, skeptico.com. His very dynamic podcast is Skeptico. Don't miss Skeptico. You can listen on, well, where can you listen? YouTube, and there's all kinds of places.
Yeah, it's like you. I've been around for a long time. You can find it anywhere. It's all free. Take it. Do what you wish. It is my journey, just shared with other people. So it's awesome. It's awesome because when I talk to people like you, Whitley, I'm able to just have a dialogue. I'm not looking to do anything other than just improve my knowledge and share what I know, what some of the unbelievable guests I've had on know.
Well, you know, you're an absolute master podcaster. You understand that. And I mean, I'm going to say it. You can't say it, but it's true. I mean, I think that when I'm on your show, I'm going to get some of the best questions that I can get. And I try to take off my podcaster hat to a degree, but we're both podcasters. And so we're obviously having a discussion here, that kind of centers around the theme of evil, why evil matters and what it is, and, so on and so forth. But Free Dreamlanders, getting back to this, please subscribe to unknowncountry.com as well. I've already told you all of the wonderful reasons to do that, but the most wonderful reason to do that is much simpler. I do depend on it. The site depends on it for its survival. It doesn't have outside advertising at all. So we need you very badly. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe. You can do it from anything from $350 for a lifetime subscription. Oh, thank you if you do that. Or $4.95 a month, or any number of different plans in between. All right. Now, when we look at this trajectory from the desert, from Aleister Crowley, from L. Ron Hubbard, through Jack Parsons, to Hal, to all other sorts of people who are all struggling for knowledge. Yes. We go back now. I turn back to that pharmacy in Pompeii, full of psychedelic drugs.
Right.
And also opium, I believe, as I recall.
Yes, I think you're right.
So, I mean, you could really have a great time in ancient Rome. You could meet the gods. And if you were in pain, you could relieve the pain by a miracle drug called opium. But not only that, you had such a powerful belief in magic that you could be cured by it. Jesus did it. He knew what he was doing. He knew that he could take his authority and he could convince people that they were cured and their diseases often would literally end. So that was all real in their world. But it was not based in what we call reality now. It was based in what we call imagination now. Where is this journey, Alex? Through the dark. Is it the dark of imagination, or is it the dark of another world that that intersects with human life in such a way that we now see it as imaginary? It's a simple question.
I was just going to say, you know, haul in the PhD students, because there we go. You know, right. There are the dissertations, guys. Go at it and take a stab at it with this broader view that consciousness is not only real, which again, it's hard to believe that science is still caught up with the idea that consciousness may be an illusion. It may be an epiphenomenon of the brain. I mean, what a non-starter, but not only that consciousness is real, but that extended consciousness, you know, this beyond it is real. And then mix into it. You know, I want to return back to something you said, because I think it's really interesting, super interesting to me, is this idea of knowledge and our quest for knowledge. And you are not only a very learned person, but you're obviously a curious person. And that drives you. And it drives me too.
Very driven by that.
But we look at the spiritual traditions and we get an inkling sometimes that in and of itself can sometimes be problematic on the spiritual journey. And I think of, you know, one of the guys I like is Eckhart Tolle. Of course, a lot of people have heard of him. But, you know, one of his great realizations as he sat on that park bench for 3 years after having that unified all consciousness experience is to let go of knowing, you know, is the way he puts it. And I have that as a personal meditation of mine, because I can be so compelled to kind of want to know the next fact, want to know the next thing, and that there's a deeper spiritual truth that comes from letting go of knowing. Not that you have to do it permanently, you know, but you can stop thinking for 5 minutes. The world won't end if you say, can I calm my mind and stop thinking? Can I let go of what I'm so sure of? Let go of knowing. And so I don't know, that doesn't at all answer your question, but in a way it kind of gets back to because the flypaper is knowing, right? The flypaper is, I want to know more. Oh, that felt so good. Let me know more. And it's never saying maybe there's a deeper truth to be found in letting go of the knowing. What do you think of that?
I think that letting go and allowing the awareness to touch the no thing is the critical moment of discovery of self and the reality in which we live. And you can't look for it. You must simply be. Then it, G. Iger Jief, of whom I have been a student for 50 years, said it beautifully in the title of one of his books. Life is real only then when I am.
Yes.
All right. Now let's get back to your book, which we've been discussing the entire time, by the way, folks. This is all, this whole discussion revolves around a central point. That point is why evil matters. Now, let's explore Satan a little bit. You start with finding Satan, and there's a very interesting concept in the chapter called, or the brief section called, Forced Choice. Can you tell us a little bit about this level of search and what it means to you?
Sure, because I think this gets at the core of what I'm trying to get across, and that is that I think we've been put in a position of trying to, you know, to back to the beginning of this conversation where we said we all have this intuitive sense that there is a reality to evil, because we have a very, very deep in our soul sense that there is good and there is bad, there is right and there is wrong. And when our culture and our society kind of is messaging us that, no, that isn't really what you see. Or worse yet, that, hey, it's kind of cool. It's kind of fun in a way, you know, and this calcification of it, it kind of creates confusion. And it also creates kind of this forced choice then, which is to say, either we go with the scientists that tell us that consciousness is an illusion, that you are meaningless, because remember, Whitley, you live in a meaningless universe. And we never really come to really process that. You mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson, that the universe is meaningless? How can there be any meaning in my life if the entire universe is meaningless? Right. It's such an absurd statement, but it's one of those we just roll past and go, oh, okay, oh yeah, I guess the planets, they don't know what they're doing, so the whole universe is meaningless. No, it's the whatever the opposite of meaningless is, that's what the universe is. You know, it's just all about meaning. That's all it ever is. So sorry to digress. We're forced into this choice of materialistic science who says that we do not essentially exist. We are biological robots in a meaningless universe. Our life is meaningless. And therefore, why would we even care about any of these things? Or we're forced into a very narrow religious interpretation of what evil should be. And we're kind of confronted with the people who want to run in there right away and go, oh, you want to know about evil? Okay. Let me tell you, I got it right here in this book. And more importantly, I will be the mediator. I will now tell you how that is, what it means, how you're supposed to live in your life. So spiritually, the reason I'm not a Christian, the reason I'm not in favor of religion is because I think there needs to be a disintermediation. I just think we are all able to, and it's our birthright to directly connect with that larger spirituality, however we do it. I mean, there's so many resources now. I mean, yeah, you give people a ton of resources, and you're not considered a spiritual scholar or a spiritual guru, but I can listen to Dreamland. I could do meditations, and I can have direct spiritual experiences that are my own. And I would suggest that those are a better path than the very susceptible to being controlled experiences that we get through religion. And I'll just add one more thing, you know, because the book, if I'm confusing people when I say why evil matters, my real point is it's not about evil, but evil may be a lens for us to understand the extent to which our deeper spiritual journey is being kind of controlled, narrowed, limited, you know, and it's kind of like the shock therapy. When you look at evil, then you're kind of woken up and go, okay, yes, there is something here that I need to pay attention to. But what we're really trying to get is the bigger, the light. That's what it's really about. So you get what I'm saying, right? Obviously.
Yeah. There is a quote in your book from Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line, which is conceivably one of the most brilliant. In fact, it is one of the most brilliant movies about evil ever made.
Yes, I so agree with
the
you.
The quote is this: what's this war in the heart of nature? What does nature vie with itself? Why does nature vie with itself? The land contend with the sea. Is there an avenging power in nature? Not one power, but two. Well, there is. Now, I have to ask you this. We talked about this earlier, that the way an atom is constructed about by two different powers in balance, kept in balance by a force, a natural force. Is that natural force the good? Is it God? Is it us? Is it conception or perception? Is there evil present when this is thrown out of balance? Because when in an atom is thrown out of balance, an immense amount of energy is released. And that energy, sometimes, some of it, essentially never dies. It becomes a form of immortal death. We blew up a lot of people in Japan using atomic weapons. They have become a central part of the reality of mankind. What are we looking at there? Are we looking into the face of evil? Because on the one hand, that happened and that was done. On the other hand, had it not been done, people like my own uncle who has went on, came back from the Pacific War to create a beautiful family, he wouldn't have come back had Truman not dropped that bomb. Almost certainly. He was a pilot. He flew Corsairs. He almost certainly wouldn't have made it out alive. And probably at least 500,000 other Americans would not come back. All of those lives that led to other lives and led to other lives would not have happened. It's true that in Japan, a couple of 100,000 lives were eradicated like that. Where's the evil? Where is the evil, Alex? I want to know.
You know, Whitley, I think one way I can always gauge when I've met a true Dharma brother, and you are my Dharma brother, is when we relate to art, because art is so beautiful in that way. And the movie Thin Red Line, which you immediately kind of identify and connect with in a deep way that I do too, I think asks that question, because that question is unanswerable. But I love the way that you dove into it. And if I could expand even further and maybe motivate people who haven't seen it to go back and watch that old movie, the visual that Malick gives us when he's saying those incredible lines about, is it one force or two vying with each other, is he's looking through this beautiful subtropical paradise of nature, but then he's focusing on the vines that are climbing up and ultimately killing the trees, right? So the vines, and sometimes are cooperative with the trees, but sometimes constrict the tree in a way that kills the tree. And it's nature vying with itself. And it is, of course, the narration on it is a soldier who's gone AWOL, not because he's afraid to enter into battle and face the prospect of dropping that bomb, which he does, because dropping that bomb is just a further extreme example of holding that rifle and shooting at anyone, right? It's the same thing, you know, one life continues, one life doesn't. But his explanation for that when he meets Sean Penn, who is the ultimate materialist, who is the ultimate shut up and calculate, get the job done. He says, I'm twice the man you are. I don't have any doubt of that. I'm not afraid of battle. I'm not afraid of anything. I'm just dealing with the real issues, and you're not, because you're just following orders. And I think there's, what can we say, my Dharma brother? I mean, we could deconstruct that movie line by line, and it is mirroring exactly what we're talking about in this conversation. It's mirroring MK Ultra. It's mirroring contact with the others. It's mirroring, after death communication and trying to form a life out of it that is meaningful from a spiritual, in a spiritual way.
You talk about at one point hypnosis, I believe. I'm not sure if I'm remembering right, if it's in the book or you've talked about it on your show. I know you've certainly talked about it on your show. And you've brought up Jenny Randles and her experience with hypnosis, where she had records of something that happened to her. And under hypnosis, she remembered the incident, but not correctly. Are you familiar with that? Yes. Now, I have, when you mentioned MK Ultra, an apparent experience with MK Ultra before it was MK Ultra in 1952, when it was just getting started. I was invited to and participated as a little boy in a program of enhanced learning that was actually extremely traumatic and almost killed me. It destroyed my immune system. Now, right now, when I think back on it, it feels unreal. And most of my life, I didn't remember it at all. But a few years ago, I brought it up with my closest friend. And he was recruited for it. He remembered he was 9 when he was recruited for it. And he was in the living room when the Air Force, 2 Air Force people who were doing the recruiting came to the house. And he listened to the recruitment pitch. And when the parents said that it would, the recruiter said it would involve the use of a Skinner box, the parents declined because they didn't care to have their son involved in a what they viewed as a very oppressive type of psychological experiment. And putting little children in boxes and playing endless repetitive things to them is not a good idea, I can assure you. If it did happen to me, it was very traumatic. Something did happen to me, and the cosmic egg was kind of cracked. So here's the question. My whole life might have started there if it really happened. And how do we know where we are? Alex, help me here. Help us.
Well, let's look to science a little bit, and let's also look to, I guess, conspiracy, no other word to put it, because we live in a conspiracy culture. When we talk about MK Ultra, we're talking about conspiracy.
Right.
No getting around it.
Well, there are real conspiracies and imaginary conspiracies, and unfortunately, the real conspiracies are being covered up by the imaginary ones. We're not going to go down that path today, but we will another time. But go ahead.
Absolutely. And so, again, a little bit of a background. How we even know MK Ultra exists is only by accident, and primarily because it was released in Canada. Because they had a different sensibility to the freedom of information, and information was brought forward and part of a lawsuit. And it was so unbelievably stunning that our government and other governments could be involved in mind control to this level. And we don't even know the extent of it, because there's overall at least 150 MK Ultra programs. We haven't even begun to identify all of them. But what happens after the Canadian exposés? It comes down to the US, and of course it's immediately shut down. They're like, we're not letting this out. This is a matter of national security. Really? Is it? And it's interesting just to kind of cross correlate your experience. You know, I just talked to a guy yesterday, Freeman Fly, and he's really kind of a super interesting character. He's been around for a long time in kind of the conspiracy culture or anything like that. And I'm talking to Freeman, and completely innocently, Whitley, here's what he says, his experience. He says, I remember when I was a kid, and it was really kind of strange, because I later found out that my dad was in intelligence and we did some strange things. But when I was a kid, I went to kindergarten and I was removed and put in a special class for gifted children.
Oh, dear.
And I told him, I said, you have to hear the rest of the story. And then I related your story to him. And it really gave him incredible pause, because he had never thought about it before. He was put in this special program where they would memorize hundreds and hundreds of cards. And that's what they were tasked to do. There was no learning. There was just a very narrowly focused kind of thing. And you go, well, that sounds a little weird, but it doesn't sound. This is the breadth of MK Ultra. We all know who Ted Kaczynski is, the Unabomber, right?
Yes.
What a lot of people don't know, but it isn't his story. It isn't. This is confirmed. Like, you get conspiracy. He is a freshman at Harvard. And we all know what it's like to be a freshman in college. It's probably one of the most vulnerable times of your life. It's your first time at home. There's all these expectations that you carry with it. If you're a man, it's your coming of age kind of period. Ted Kaczynski goes to a class at the at Harvard, and he's immediately subjected to unbelievable ridicule and humiliation as part of this class. It's part of a project, he later finds. This is later identified as being a sub-program in MK Ultra, because not all MK Ultra was Skinner cages and the dissociative identity experiments, although those were done. Not all of them were LSD experiments with people who didn't volunteer and were unwitting, although those were done. Not all of them were brainwashing, although those were done. Some of them was, let us see this guy at Harvard, see the kind of impact we can have on a freshman if we just do kind of basic social pressure, social manipulation, and making you feel like an outsider. Ted Kaczynski goes home after his first year, and he's a changed person. And his brother says he's now saying all sorts of things about how the world really sucks and everyone's out to get you. And he's saying all it has changed his personality. So when you, one of the things that's so awesome about you, Whitley, is your openness to explore this and your resistance to being kind of bullshitted one way or another. You come back and go, did that really happen? How does memory work? How does hypnosis really work? Which we don't know, by the way. So do you want to speak to?
Well, I'll tell you this. Curiosity didn't kill this cat. Curiosity made this cat a lot stronger. And I have too much curiosity to close those questions. But I do have to close something right now, Free Dreamlanders. And I'm so sorry that I'm doing this. But we're going to go on with this extraordinary conversation. And you're not going to be here. How about becoming proactive in your life? And saying to yourself, I want to go on with this conversation. I want to participate in the commentary section on Unknown Country. I want to engage with this material in a very serious way. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe. And in the meantime, on your way, on your journey, stop by wherever you buy books and get Why Evil Matters. And if you don't find it there, then go back in a week or two and it will be there. And don't miss Skeptico. Skeptico is essential listening, as you can tell. I mean, how extraordinary Alex is. Skeptico, Why Evil Matters, Unknown Country. Three sides of a triad, right? Okay. Right on. Free Dreamlanders, we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.